from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Jennifer White in for Cynthia Canty. Today, we look at the state's expanding corrections budget and what can be done to slow its growth.
Just throwing people into prison and keeping them there for ever longer periods of time, this just isn't really working.
We find out about a pilot program that moves your interaction with the court system online.
You know, essentially, this allows litigants to raise questions and to do that in a way that's unlike just calling into the court.
And we talked to a couple who faced down the diagnosis of an extremely rare cancer.
That we had done all the right things and still got this cancer, I couldn't believe it.
And of course, we'll have all the results of yesterday's primary election. That's ahead on Stateside. Navigating the court system can be time-consuming, intimidating, and for some of us, frankly, overwhelming. So imagine being able to talk to the judge and challenge a traffic ticket, for instance, without stepping foot in a courtroom. I'm Jennifer White, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we find out about a pilot program that moves your interaction with the court system online. Then later in the hour, we talk to a couple who faced down the diagnosis of an extremely rare cancer and beat the odds. But first, we start the show today with a look at the results of yesterday's primary election. Joining me is co-host of Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics, Zoe Clark. Hi, Zoe.
Hi, Jen.
So we headed into the primaries yesterday with this continued fight between Tea Party Republicans and establishment Republicans. Who won? Yeah. Who lost?
Well, I think it's a draw. I mean, I think it's probably fair to say that you said it was a continued fight, and the fight is going to continue. It's been interesting to watch, particularly in the congressional races, this so-called Tea Party establishment GOP intra-party fight. We watched in the 3rd Congressional District on the west side of Michigan, Justin Amash beat businessman Brian Ellis. Justin Amash has been a thorn to the establishment. He comes from sort of the Rand Paul libertarian side of government.
Right.
And there were people who were unhappy with him, but he made it in the primary. But then you look at the 11th Congressional District in southeast Michigan, and David Trott beat incumbent Carrie Benevolio. Carrie Benevolio making lots of headlines for things that he would probably rather not have made headlines for. And so the establishment stepped up. David Trott ran a professional campaign. He won there. And then you look at the 8th Congressional District. That's the seat that Congressman Mike Rogers is retiring from to start a radio career. And in that seat, former state senator Mike Bishop of the establishment wing of the GOP beat Tea Partier Tom McMillan. So it's a bit of a draw. I mean, I think both sides can say, hey, we won some, we lost some. And I think the so-called fight will continue.
Looking at the race overall, this was a good time to be an incumbent.
It was. That is another takeaway from last night. And that's usually what political watchers believe. Incumbents, you know, they have the organization, they have name recognition. And if you haven't done something really, really bad, people know you and they tend to vote for you. So incumbents did well, House and State Senate seats. But there was one interesting loss from a Republican incumbent, Representative Frank Foster of Petoskey, only Republican incumbent to lose. People are talking about his support for the Medicaid expansion. And Frank Foster is a millennial, young, and he was talking about pushing for extending the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act to LGBT rights. He was talking about this last summer before Governor Snyder said, hey, legislature, let's start debating it. And so there's some talk that maybe that hurt him up north.
Hmm. Well, we also know there was a major ballot initiative on the ballot yesterday, Proposal 1. Governor Snyder was worried about whether it would pass. People were concerned about low voter turnout, but it did pass and by a substantial margin.
It did, almost 2-1. Right now, unofficial results put in favor 69%. If you read comments on Michigan Radio's website, on newspaper websites, it appeared that this was going to fail. But if you didn't read the comments and you actually talked to voters, it looked like proponents of Prop 1 did a good enough job of taking this really what can be agreed poorly written proposal that confused many, many people and did enough to try to explain it to voters. Lots of business folks, lots of local chambers of commerce, Governor Snyder and Democrats coming together bipartisanly to push for this proposal. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there.
You know, we witnessed the end of a long chapter in a political career with the ouster of Robert Ficano as Wayne County executive. What does this say about what's happening there?
I think voters were fed up. I think they were fed up with the headlines. This was an administration just besought by scandal. I mean, there are Ficano staffers serving prison sentences right now. I think people were saying enough is enough. And I think there's something to do with the fact that if this also isn't something going on about a rejuvenation of Detroit and seeing new leadership in Detroit, whether you agree with that leadership or not, but making tough decisions and feeling like it was time to put new leadership in there. And so, yeah, I mean, this was a 11-person Democratic primary for this Wayne County executive seat. Now, this is a Democratic district, most likely, so whoever won in that primary is likely to win. And Ficano came in fifth out of 11 behind Warren Evans, Bill Wild, Phil Kavanaugh, Kevin McNamara. So that was interesting for Detroit watchers and all of Wayne County to watch. And it is most likely that it is Warren Evans will become Wayne County's next chief executive.
Anything else stand out in this primary for you?
Well, the fact that it looks like Michigan will have two female congresswomen come November. Now, again, this is the primary. We keep saying likely, but these two districts, the 12th district and 14th, are Democratic districts. And Debbie Dingell, wife of the Dean of the House, Democrat John Dingell, he is retiring. She beat her opponent last night. So it looks like she will be Michigan's next congresswoman, as will Brenda Lawrence, Southfield mayor. She beat her opponents last night, Rudy Hobbs and Hanson Clark. So in addition to Republican Candace Miller and then Senator Debbie Stabenow, it looks like Michigan will have two new female congresswomen.
Well, we wrapped up the primaries and now we head towards November.
Exactly. That's where all eyes are going to be on. And of course, the big races, right? We've got a gubernatorial race and an open Senate seat, which really got very little attention because they didn't have primary opponents. So now the bigger races, the top of the ballot races, will start taking more media attention and more money. And so that's what we'll all be watching for.
Well, we'll brace ourselves for the onslaught of commercials.
Yes.
Zoe Clark is co-host of Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics. Zoe, thanks.
Thank you.
We all have a passion. It may be jazz or classic cars. Maybe it's public radio. Well, for James Hancock, professor of horticulture at Michigan State University, that passion is blueberries. James Hancock is here now. Welcome to Stateside.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well. You know, you've spent the last 30 years breeding blueberries. What is it about this fruit?
What is it about the fruit? Well, it's a tasty fruit. It's a nutritious fruit. And it's easy to pick and store.
Now, in terms of blueberry species, there are high bush blueberries and low bush blueberries. The low bush are the wild variety. But for those high bush blueberries, the kind you work with, how many different types exist?
Well, there's dozens. Breeders have been very active for the last 50 years on them. So there's a lot of them out there.
And while you have the Aurora, the Draper, and the Liberty, those are your most famous varieties, how many total varieties have you developed?
Six. I just released two new ones, Osorno and Calypso, and a previous one named Huron.
So how do they differ from each other?
In season, Draper is much earlier than the other two. And that's the major difference between them. There's some differences in flavor as well, but the major difference is the seasons.
So when you're creating a new variety of blueberry, are you looking for certain characteristics, or is it really more about that harvest time?
Well, the harvest time is important, but really the primary character that you're looking for is fruit quality and ultimately flavor. I mean, that's the bottom line. But you can't release something with good flavor that isn't productive, so you have to consider that as well.
And when you talk about a good-flavored blueberry, is it sweetness, is it tartness, is it a balance between the two?
It's a balance between the two. I think most people like it sweet, but with a little bit of tart. so a complex flavor.
Hmm. Now, many people are concerned about genetically modified organisms or GMOs. Are your berries GMOs?
No, they're not. They're not GMOs. They're done naturally by, you know, putting pollen onto the flower of another plant.
Some of your varieties are being grown as far away as Chile and South Korea. How does it feel knowing your work is reaching that far?
Well, I mean, it's outstanding. I mean, I feel, you know, very happy about that. You know, the wider they're used, the happier I am.
Do you have a favorite variety?
Well, my favorite variety of the group is probably Liberty, because it's a later variety, but it's really sweet and tasty.
And what about a favorite recipe? I know that's a hard question.
I'm not much of a cook myself, but I'll tell you that the great thing about blueberries is you can pick them, you can freeze them, you know, without a whole lot of preparation, and just pour them on stuff, salads and oatmeal, and that's the way I like them.
So if I'm in the grocery store and I want to pick out the perfect pint of blueberries, what should I look for?
Wow. Well, where it's from, if it's from Michigan, you've got a high probability of getting mine. But I think you want to look for plump berries, powder blueberries, and obviously no mold or anything like that.
Jim Hancock is professor of horticulture at Michigan State University. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure. Enjoyed it.
This is Stateside. I'm Jennifer White, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. A cancer diagnosis, either for yourself or for someone you love, is a deeply frightening experience. When Greg Holmes received the diagnosis of a very rare and highly fatal cancer, he and his wife, Catherine Roth, found themselves trying to find hope in what seemed like a hopeless situation. They've shared their journey in the memoir, The Good Fight, a story of cancer, love, and triumph. Greg, Catherine, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much. It's a pleasure being here.
Greg, tell us about this very rare cancer you were diagnosed with.
Well, it's interesting, Jennifer, because I thought I had a stuffy nose for a long time, and I'd struggled with nose congestion. After the biopsy, it was discovered that I actually had a cancer by the name of sinusal nasal undifferentiated cancer. And that is a very extremely rare cancer and one of the most deadly. And we did a little bit of research. We looked into it right away. And the other thing we found out was that there's no survivors.
When you first received that diagnosis, you heard it from Catherine. And Catherine, actually, I want you to read a portion of the book where you had to tell Greg about the biopsy results. Mm-hmm. Will you read that portion for us?
Sure. I hesitated, as one does when facing a huge precipice. I knew that telling Greg would make it real and send us free-falling into a nightmare. I longed to hold back and return to our innocence, but reality pushed me forward. I asked Greg if he was sitting down, and then I jumped. I don't remember how I told him or the words I chose, but each one felt cruel. Each word was irretrievable, shattering our world and life as we knew it. Nothing remained except the harsh, windswept shoreline of our tentative future.
Life turned on a dime for you in that moment.
Right.
And you all also have a daughter, Emerson.
Right.
At that time, she was 3 years old. We had a three-year-old daughter. Yeah.
So what happens at a heart level for you, Catherine, when you first hear that and you know that you have to be the bearer of bad news to your husband? And you're a physician, so this may not have been the only time you've had to give bad news to people.
Right, but it's totally different when it's your dearest friend and lover. But when I wrote this, it was almost like post-traumatic stress for me to write about it because I was in sort of an altered state that people go through when they're given devastating news. It's like the whole world recedes and you're just, you know, it's indescribable. I tried to capture it in that paragraph, how it's kind of irretrievable and you have to go forward, but you don't want to.
Now, Greg, your reaction was very interesting to me once Catherine told you. Will you read that portion
of the
book?
Sure, I'd be happy to today. What? How could I have cancer? Catherine and I had been the poster children of good health for many years. Neither of us smoked. We both drank half a glass of red wine each evening. Our diet was replete with organic fruits and vegetables, and we exercised routinely. We meditated. We did our yoga stretches. We went off as seekers on spiritual retreats. We helped many others change their unhealthy habits and states of mind. We were so good.
That line, we were so good. Did you feel like you were being punished for something, or was it just you were in a state of disbelief?
Exactly, Jennifer. I was in the state of disbelief. I couldn't believe it. I was shell-shocked. I could not believe it. Us, we had run a cancer support group at a couple of hospitals. I know many cancer patients. I knew their history. But to think that we had done all the right things and still got this cancer, I couldn't believe it.
Hmm. Now, the path you took in facing this diagnosis and facing, Greg, your recovery, how would you describe that path?
Well, Catherine and I, after we halfway got our heads together, I don't think we ever got our heads together during the whole process, totally. I don't think you can. But after we recovered from the initial shock and we went to the University of Michigan Cancer Center, we looked at each other, grabbed each other's hands and said, we've got to do anything and everything we can to fight this. Everything. We've got to fight fire with fire. And I think some patients, everyone differs in their motivation, but I had everything to live for and I wasn't about to give up, even though it was a terrible cancer with a horrible prognosis and no survivors.
So when you say we have to fight fire with fire, we have to throw everything at this, Catherine, what was the everything?
Jennifer, actually, when I first came out with the diagnosis, I started then. I didn't even wait till we got to Ann Arbor. I started to think about this as comprehensively as I could because we knew. I mean, even the Commonwealth's Wall Street Journal, that work Greg had read earlier in the book from, was about how terrible it was and people were not surviving. So I quickly felt like everything. And everything to me meant turning to the natural world of herbs and things that has enhanced the immune system and help with inflammation and just a battery of things, looking really primarily first at nutrition. And that's where I started and built on that, as the book describes, with a lot of research and perseverance about what else, which included acupuncture and other nutritional things that I came to learn about. I was on a quest. I couldn't sleep, and I was searching and turned to the literature that's growing out there, which is exciting to me.
I'm curious, because you are a physician, were there times when this sort of non-traditional, more holistic approach to Greg's diagnosis, did it bump up against your training? Where,
no.
Never. So you found a place where they met?
Because I felt from the beginning of with going into medicine to be that kind of a healer that there was more to do to engage the healing within the person than just bombarding them from without. So I was oriented that way. So that did position me where I would have felt more conflict not doing it.
Now, that's not to say that you didn't use the traditional methods.
Right.
You sort of did everything.
Exactly. Because, Jennifer, the sad fact is about cancer, and for your listeners, is that we have not made very much progress with cancer. Cancer is a terrible diagnosis, and except for there's some exceptions with some types of cancer, testicular cancer, leukemia, lung cancer rates have declined primarily because people smoke less, but cancer, we've spent since 1971, we have spent $100 billion or more, and we're really not getting anywhere so fast. So what Catherine brought into the picture was we knew that the doctors, they did their best, the oncologists, but we knew we had to bring something else. We knew we had to bring everything into the picture, nutrition and these supplements that Catherine researched and discovered. So,
Catherine, I'm curious because you are a physician and part of the book is focused on how to be, or the importance really of being your own medical advocate or having the people around you advocate for you. Do you think you were better prepared to do that because you have a medical background and lots of people don't?
True.
And so they find themselves in these positions and don't know the questions to ask and don't know.
Right.
How
I think most cancer patients need an advocate, need someone, because like as Greg was saying, his world was shattered and he was just barely coping. Someone needs to be helping them, champion them through that, because the cancer therapies, as you know, are very It's a tightrope to get through them, and sometimes they're so devastated by the treatment themselves that their health starts to deteriorate so much, which did with Greg. I mean, he was not in an optimal state, obviously, when he got done with his treatment. But I just feel with my work that there are things that are actually complementary that would enhance chemotherapy, enhance survivals. And like as Greg said, if we had it down and everybody was getting through cancer without a blemish and we had this all figured out, I would be like, of course I'm not going to interfere. But we need to think more globally and more holistically about this disease to help people survive. And the complacency, or maybe it's not complacency, but the intimidation that many cancer patients feel going through it, that they're not empowered, they don't know what to do, and they're really, in deferment to their oncologist in a fear state. Even if I get someone to make a shake, to do something that they're engaging and they're thinking about their own health and immune system, helps them psychologically, if not physically. So I'm all for a holistic, integrative, I call that, approach to cancer, because it's not, as Greg said, we're not getting very far yet. I think we could do better. And that's the real message of this book, is there is things people can do. There is hope. There is empowerment. And I try to be very specific in the book with references and charts and stuff so that the story is woven there, but the information, if you want it, is also accessible. So it can be used in multiple ways.
I think some people reading the book, though, because you talk about the integrative approach to medicine, they'll say, look, it's cancer. We know what to do about cancer. It's chemo, it's radiation. Mm-hmm. There may be some new drugs out there that people are testing, right. But I just, great shakes and, mushrooms or what have you, but I'm not going to go there because I don't know anything about it. I don't trust right. it. Mm-hmm. And this is what we know works, is the chemo and radiation. What do you say
to people? So I would just counter that. Do we really think it works? I mean, we do think it works in some situations, and as Greg says, they're rare, but there's a lot of people that I see that have gotten through chemo and radiation and really haven't made a lot of changes in either their lifestyle or their nutrition, and they come back to me, see me when it's recurred. I think you have to be more, like as Greg said, fight with fire with fire. You have to be aggressive with this. This is not, a sore throat.
Well, I think it's interesting too, Jennifer, that psychologically what's happening with people, because when people hear the word cancer, they, like me, well, it's like a deer in the headlights. They are so afraid. And when they're in that fear state, the position of their oncologist is elevated almost to a demigod. The oncologist is seen as the only expert, the only hope they have, and they will listen to him or her only. Even though some cancer patients come and see Catherine and for her advice, and she'll give them very good advice about other things they can do as well as the chemo, but then they'll tell their oncologist, and the oncologist will say, you can't do that. That'll interfere with the chemotherapy. And it's an outrageous claim by the oncologist, and it's simply not true. Oncologists are people who know a tremendous amount about very little.
Jennifer, there are centers that are beginning to really, there's research. If you wanted to Google it, I mean, that's the power of the internet. You can look at curcumin, which is a very common spice from the turmeric, and look at it in many different cancers. There's, scientific research behind it. It's not just your local health food store. There really is science building around treating inflammation as a key pin in cancer. And if you can take natural anti-inflammatories, it's helpful. I mean, even at U of M now, they're doing research with curcumin and head and neck cancers.
What was interesting to me about the book was the relationship part of it, not just to one another, but also to your village, if you will.
Yes.
And I'm curious what you learned about each other through this process, but also what you learned about the importance of having that outside support network, having the community around you be there to support you both as a patient and as a caregiver. Catherine, I'll ask you first.
It was an experience to, one, go through it, but it was also a huge experience to write the book. Because Greg and I semi-protected each other from really knowing what we really thought, what really was going on. So writing the book, I learned things, reading what Greg wrote about it, that I had never known. I did not know what went on in the radiation center. When he talks about those experiences and those relationships, I didn't know that. He didn't know a lot what I was going through. So it was a huge healing for us to listen to each other's voices. The part about friendships, I mean, maybe Greg, you can answer that, because I know that was a big part for you, was having a lot of support from our friends.
I had several friends who I had great relationships with, who loved me and who would do anything for me. And that support in when you study things in research about medical illness, you know, social support is a big factor. And I was so blessed that I had so much social support. We would get letters, cards all the time, sometimes from people we had no idea, I'd never met. It was a community outpouring. In a way, I felt held by our community in Traverse City and just loved. And I just owe so much to so many people there. And I hope I live longer so I can give it back.
And how is your health?
My health is great right now. Well, let's ask my physician. She's right. She's in the studio with us today. I don't know if I want to hear, but go ahead.
Yeah. Greg's doing great. I mean, he's never really gained his full weight back. And so there's a frailness that he never had. So, you know, it's great. But he did go ahead and lose, in the book that references the radiation may take out his eye. And a year or two ago, he did lose vision in his left eye. So, but he says he sees better with one than he ever did with two.
Yeah, and I think that's a remarkable thing here, Jennifer, is that when we, Catherine and I, ran a heart group, and then for people that had heart attacks and different things going on, cardiac events, and some of the people would talk about the gifts of their heart attack or the gifts of their illness, and we'd listen to them. And I remember one man, and he just, after his heart attack, he was a AAA personality accountant, and he was talking about he'd just sit in his backyard and listen to birds sing, to the point that it really concerned his wife. And I'm telling you, Catherine's right. I've had a lot of things happen to me. I've lost a lot of things. I've lost my left eye. I've lost my thyroid gland. I've lost my sense of smell. My hearing isn't as good as it used to be. Had a heart attack. Probably the stress of what we went through contributed to that. But I'm telling you, I have so much. I have so much more in some ways because of the cancer, because I almost died. I wish I could communicate that to listeners. We tried to do that a little bit in the book, but I wish I could say that don't take life for granted. I do see better with one eye because now I look at you, Jennifer, and I see you. You know, whereas before I'd see you, but now I wouldn't see you. I'd talk to you on the phone, and I enjoy talking to you on the phone, you know. And I just love life, and I'm starting to tear up as I'm talking about this, and your listeners can't see that, but I'll tell them that. But I just wish that for everyone. Don't wait. Don't wait to have a serious illness and get out there and, you know, I mean, hug your daughter. Or your son or your wife or your partner, whatever, just... They're there now.
You all had a close relationship before the illness.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Catherine, the husband you have now, what would you say about him?
He's great. He's a fantastic person. We worked really as a team. There wasn't a lot. I've seen certain cancer diagnoses where people actually have to go through divorce and separation. And you know, we didn't have that. So I really think it propelled us into really working together. And as hard as it was for Greg at sometimes to do what I was championing, he was a very eager person to do whatever he could. He was not ambivalent at all. He hates needles. You'll learn that in the book. But he would allow me to do acupuncture and drink things and take things. And so I encourage people to give it as much as you can. Give yourself over to the healing of the illness, to see the opportunities that are there and not just see the fear and the diagnosis. Go for, you know, whatever you can. But Greg is, he's always been a great person, but he's just wiser now, I think, and a little more savors things. He's slowed down a little bit so that he really doesn't want to rush around and be multitasking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what I've learned through the process was how important it is for a husband to do what their wife says.
And listeners across the state rejoice. Greg Holmes and Catherine Roth are the authors of The Good Fight, a story of cancer, love, and triumph. Greg, Catherine, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much, Jennifer. It's been a pleasure.
And you can find The Good Fight on Amazon.com. This is Stateside. I'm Jennifer White, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Navigating the court system can be time-consuming, intimidating, and let's be honest, overwhelming. But what if there was a way to resolve a minor civil infraction or a traffic ticket without stepping foot in a courtroom?
J.J. Prescott is professor of law at the University of Michigan and co-director of the Empirical Legal Studies Center. He led the team that designed the online court project, a first-of-its-kind technology. J.J., welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So instead of spending a chunk of my day trying to take care of that traffic ticket, this technology would help me resolve that dispute in minutes. Why did it take so long for technology like this to enter the court system?
To be honest, law is a confusing area generally for the public, and courts are run by judges and organized by judges who have been trained in a very particular way to deal with disputes, which is to get people in front of them, to try to get the information they need in front of them, and to make a decision to everybody there present. It's really the focus on in-person to try to get the information they need in front of them and to make a decision with everybody there present. It's really the focus on in-person ways of resolving disputes that has really hung us up in this area for so long.
So how did you first identify that there was a need or a use for this technology?
I think if you talk to almost anybody about their experience with the courts, other than jury duty, it's spent down in the court dealing with, hopefully a minor infraction, either a traffic infraction or some kind of outstanding fine or fee. And oftentimes people don't understand why. Well, sure, they can pay it. They can just, send in money. But if they have questions or if they think something is not quite right with how the ticket or the fine has been issued, they really don't know what to do. Sure, they could call a lawyer, but that's often prohibitively expensive. And so they get in their car and they go down to the courthouse. Sometimes they make an appointment in advance, but the appointment in advance is generally a cattle call type situation where you're asked to show up at 8:30 in the morning and the court will promise to get you out of there by 5, if at all possible. And then it just sort of proceeds in some sort of order that is inexplicable and not understood by most people. And a lot of people come out caring less about how it wound up being resolved than how much the situation lacked transparency, and they oftentimes really don't understand what just happened.
Hmm. So how does this technology change that interaction with the court system?
Really, it's an opportunity for litigants to have a guided interaction with decision makers. So oftentimes, it's either a member of the government, a prosecutor, or perhaps a police department, and a judge that wind up making a lot of the decisions. And, essentially, this allows litigants to raise questions, to ask for a change in their current status, and to do that in a way that's unlike just calling into the court and trying to call somebody, talk to somebody who can help them understand, or sending a random email in to somebody, if you can find such a thing anywhere on a court website. Instead, it asks the right questions, collects the right information from the litigant, and presents the right information and the request to the judge or the prosecutor and allows them to make the decision quickly and efficiently and oftentimes with better information than they otherwise would have.
So let's say, theoretically, of course, I get a speeding ticket. I'm going 5 or 10 miles over the limit. And so I've got this ticket in front of me. What would I do to use your technology?
Sure. So if our technology was in place in the area where you received your ticket, you would go to the court's website. You would find a place to enter in your infraction number or some other way to identify the dispute. And once you locate your dispute, you would request some sort of treatment. So if what you want is to contend that you weren't going as fast as the police officer said, or that you have a great traffic record and you're wondering whether or not this might be bumped down to something that won't put as many points on your license, something of that sort, that is where you would do it. So you'd ask for your ticket to be reviewed. You would have the opportunity to sort of explain the situation. And, the questions, after you answered the questions, your information would be sent either to a prosecutor or the police, and the police would add their 2 cents about how they want it treated. And if they are interested in helping you get to a different place with where your dispute had been, the information collected from both sides will be forwarded to a judge, and the judge will make a decision.
So what you're describing is something that happens from behind computer screens and keyboards. And I wonder whether there's anything lost in that lack of human interaction, being able to stand in front of someone face to face and, them being able to look at you and see you as a person as opposed to just, text on a screen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. This is a central core issue that this kind of technology is facing. And to be honest, one of the reasons why it's taken so long. A lot of people really value that aspect of resolving their disputes. But here's the thing. When the case is serious, there's a lot of value to in-person interaction. judges can have time to sort of really evaluate the situation, take a look at the person, and to exercise their discretion. But for, you know, a large majority of what courts do, there is very little discretion being exercised. So even if you can get in front of a judge, the judge has very particular things that drive the decision the judge is making, and those things can be provided to the judge in much more efficient, quick, easy to digest ways. So, you know, rather than spending 6 hours waiting to get in front of a judge who will literally rubber stamp some decision that has essentially been pre-made, you know, we're presenting litigants and courts with the opportunity to sort of make it much easier on the litigant while at the same time actually giving more information to a judge. So judges will always have the opportunity, if they want, to say, you know what, I need more information. I'm going to not resolve this dispute over this system, and I'm going to encourage the litigant to come down to court. And of course, the litigant retains that option. But in our view, most of what is gained is outweighed dramatically by how costly it is for litigants to go down and how quick and rubber stamp-like the decisions are once you're there.
So this project has been working as a pilot program in Washtenaw County. How has it been working? What have you heard from the litigant side of things and from the judicial side of things?
Well, we've had a pilot going on in Pittsfield Township so far, and I can tell you that the courts and the judges, in particular the magistrate that has been dealing with this, they've really enjoyed the technology. In their view, it makes their lives much easier. They had at the 14A 1 District Court a mediation program, an in-person mediation program, which they've now scrapped in favor of this technology. And it's a small-scale pilot, so, you know, there's a lot for us left to learn, and that's what we're hoping to do over the next few years. But at this stage, the court personnel and the judges are very happy with it. They get the information they need, and they make their decisions. Sometimes they're denying requests. Most of the times they're granting requests, which is great. That means certain litigants have saved hours and money to go downtown and or go down to the courthouse and try to resolve their dispute. They've been able to do it online. And in terms of actual litigants, one of our big concerns was whether or not litigants would actually use this sort of system, and it seems that they are. They are, and they're using it well. They're putting in the information that's necessary for the system to send them a text message or an email to confirm that their request has been received and to provide them with instructions if they have a request granted. And that's been fantastic. We have a lot more to learn about how to engage litigants with this sort of system. We're particularly concerned with making sure that everybody can access and use this system equally, and also that people come out of an interaction with the court system this way feeling as if they have been treated fairly and that their concerns have been addressed. And that's one of the parts of the technology we're really hoping to improve going forward.
You know, when we talk about implementing technology, we hear a lot about increased efficiency on the back end, but there's usually an upfront cost that has to be negotiated. Is this an expensive system to implement, and could that potentially be a barrier?
The biggest barriers, I think, to using this sort of technology are actually just going against what people are used to. We have a lot of people who work in the courts, and they've been doing things for a long time in a very particular kind of way. And technology like this is disruptive to the existing workflow of the courts. Once you get the system designed, once you figure out how judges want to see the information displayed, how best to have litigants interact with the courts, this is the great thing about technology is that it's scalable. It's the sort of thing that if you make it in a flexible way, additional courts will be able to adopt it fairly easily. We hope it won't disrupt their system so much. And as far as actually building the technology itself, you know, that me and my team are in charge of, it's much cheaper than you would expect. And the upside is quite substantial.
Ultimately, what kind of potential do you think this technology has to transform how the legal system works?
Our initial approach to this was, let's identify the kinds of transactions that are extremely routine and take up a lot of court resources and figure out whether or not those decisions are really driven on both the government side and the judge's side and the litigant side by just a few pieces of information. Those are the low-hanging fruit, as it were. And every court has these kinds of low-hanging fruit. The biggest problem is, from our perspective, is that the types of low-hanging fruit in each court differ. You know, this is an open question for us, how easy it's going to be to adjust and adapt the system throughout the state of Michigan and hopefully nationally. But we're confident that, you know, that there's a core set of transactions, you know, that really are the same across courts and that it shouldn't be too hard. But, you know, we still have a lot to learn.
J.J. Prescott is professor of law at the University of Michigan and co-director of the Empirical Legal Studies Center. He led the team that designed the online court project. J.J., thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
In recent weeks, we've heard a lot about problems with Aramark, the company providing food service to Michigan prisons. The issues ranged from food shortages to inappropriate behavior between Aramark staff members and prisoners. So exactly why did the legislature decide to privatize food service at Michigan prisons? Well, in short, to save money, because Michigan's correction budget now tops $2 billion. In 1980, the corrections budget was 3% of the state budget. In 2013, it soared to over 21%. Here with us now is Ken Sikkema, former Senate Majority Leader and Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Welcome back, Ken.
Oh, happy to be with you.
In the last decade and a half, the Michigan prison population has more than tripled. Do we know what caused that steep increase?
We're dealing with the legacy of the sort of tough-on-crime approach that started in the 1980s. And there was an increase in drug use, kind of an increase in crime, some urban chaos. And one of the approaches was the attitude that we just need to get tough on crime. And so, as you point out, in 1980, our prison budget was about 3% of the state's general fund, and now, after building dozens and dozens of prisons and going from about 16,000 prisoners to almost 45,000 prisoners, the budget is 20% of the general fund. And that's raised a lot of concerns about that kind of percentage is crowding out other state priorities.
That tough-on-crime stance, as you said, it comes up a lot when we look at political races. So is this really primarily an issue of politics? Because if you're talking about being tough on crime, what else does that mean other than locking people up?
Well, that's the approach that was taken, and it was taken in a bipartisan fashion. And it's happened in states around the country. But you're now hearing voices, and these are conservative voices as well as non-conservative voices that are saying, wait a minute, this isn't really working. Just throwing people into prison and keeping them there for ever longer periods of time and not doing much to get them ready to come out, because most of them do eventually get out of prison, this just isn't really working. It's not driving down crime rates. It's taking a lot of taxpayer money. And there are voices now, and like I said, a lot of these are conservative voices saying, let's take a look at this. Let's look at who's in prison. Let's take a look at what we need to get them ready to assume a proper place in society when they get out. We see an increase in the use of drug courts or mental health courts to try to deal with some of the more systemic problems that this group of people face. And I think that's an encouraging sign.
So is that part of the problem that in Michigan, the prison system has become sort of a catch-all? So if we have someone who's dealing with a mental health issue or dealing with a drug problem, the prisons have become a place to hold people who we really don't know what else to do with.
I don't really subscribe to the view that there's a lot of people in prison who haven't had a violent past. It's actually pretty difficult, if that's the right word, to get into a Michigan prison in terms of past criminal behavior. But it's also true that along with a violent past, you have things like drug use and you have mental health problems. And if we refuse to deal with those problems, these people are just going to be back in prison at once after their release. So I think it's encouraging that we're starting to look at things beyond just the crimes they committed. We're looking at some of the other challenges they face that are barriers for them to become, you know, useful and productive members of society. But really, if you look at the prison population in Michigan, as in a lot of other states, I mean, these people have committed some pretty serious crimes.
So when we look at the actual cost increase, you know, we know it costs more to incarcerate very young people and older people, because as people age, they're dealing with health problems. So is part of this, you know, a very young prison population and also an aging prison population that has special needs?
Well, because of this kind of tough on crime and building up of the prison population started in the 80s, you do now have in Michigan, as in other states, an increasingly older population. And some of these people are just, I mean, they're in wheelchairs. They're probably better suited, if you will, for kind of a nursing home, a skilled nursing facility situation than a prison. and they also cost the taxpayer a lot of money when you try to take care of them in prison. Michigan is somewhat unique, though, in terms of why our prison budget is so high. We have a higher cost per prisoner than the average around the country, and prisoners in Michigan prisons serve longer sentences for the same crime than the average. And those are two issues that Michigan has to deal with, the longer sentences and the higher cost per prisoner in our state.
You know, we definitely want a safe community. But how good is Michigan at dealing with recidivism, helping parolees stay out of prison and become functioning, contributing members of society?
Michigan actually ranks pretty well when you compare us to other states in terms of what's called this recidivism rate, or people getting out of prison and then coming back in. But there's still a lot more we could do that would help enormously in keeping people from going back into prison. The Council of State Governments is finishing up a major study here in Michigan. They're going to have some recommendations on what can be done. There are some innovative programs that have actually the legislature mandated that could help a lot if we put some more resources into this. And long term, I think the goal just needs to be to take this 20%, this $2 billion, and stabilize it. So over time, it becomes, you know, it goes down to 19 and 18 and 17 and 16% of the general fund. And like I said, for the reason we can use that money for other priorities.
This is one of those issues where you have people on both sides of the aisle agreeing that the corrections budget has gotten out of control. You've served on the legislature. You know, what kind of leadership needs to happen in this case? Concrete next steps to keep people focused on this issue in the legislature, but also to get some momentum moving forward.
Well, I already mentioned that one of the most encouraging signs, in my opinion, is you have conservative voices calling for a review of this approach to corrections. And the reason that's encouraging is that because Republicans are still in control in Michigan, and conservative Republicans in terms of the legislature. Now, we have an election coming up, and you know, that remains to be seen whether that continues to be the case. But in places like Michigan and in places like Texas, you have conservative legislators calling for a review of corrections policy. And because in many of these states, Republicans have the majority, that's why I think that's the most encouraging sign that I see.
Ken Sikkema is former Senate Majority Leader and Senior Policy Fellow at Public Sector Consultants. Ken, thanks so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scon. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Jennifer White. Thanks for listening.